Welcome to Mysterious Goings On, the podcast about creativity, writing, and mystery. Every week, we talk about all kinds of great fiction and meet the people who write it. We also feature explorations about creativity in all walks of life. Your host, Alex Greenwood, will join you right after this.
Why do authors love mysterious goings-on? Let me count the ways, but here's a great one from author Linda Stuart Henley, author of Kate's War.
Well, thank you, Alex. I enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciated the fact that you were able to say all the right things, so I didn't have to say them myself, like repeatedly say, please read Kate's War. I didn't want to do that. That's not for me to say, but you could say it better, and you did. And thank you so very much.
Well, it is my pleasure to welcome you to yet another captivating episode of Mysterious Goings On, where today we're thrilled to feature a dynamic literary duo, M.M. Downing and S.J. Wall. These co-authors have woven a rich tapestry. See, that's how you know AI helped me, because AI loves the word tapestry. It's a clue. So you just learned something, folks. But anyway, it's woven a rich tapestry of history and adventure in their middle grade trilogy, The Adventures of the Flash Gang. Episode 1, Exploding Experiment. Their books transport readers to 1930s Pittsburgh, where a street orphan and his diverse crew outwit pro-Nazi plots, offering a timely echo to the current political climate. I like it already. Downing and Waugh, who found their creative spark in a writer's group, share a passion for the atmospheric adventures that captivated them as children. Their collaboration has birthed a world of colorful characters and deep-rooted friendships that resonate with readers of all ages, especially as they draw parallels with modern American politics. We're going to go explore these mysteries of Pittsburgh with the Adventures of the Flash Gang. Welcome again to the show, Downing and Waugh.
Thank you for having us.
My goodness, Pittsburgh, really? That's, you know, I always think, next series I write, I'm going to base it in Pittsburgh. Why not Pittsburgh? So seriously, though, Pittsburgh in the 30s, it's such a distinctive backdrop for your trilogy. And given that, as far as I know, neither of you hail from the Steel City.
We don't.
Why Pittsburgh? Why?
Melanie, do you want to field or should I jump in?
I mean, we're both from the East Coast. And so, yes, why Pittsburgh for us? We wanted a setting that was a character. And Pittsburgh is just amazing. We were looking for something to evoke the 1850s London of our favorite Dickens books. We wanted something gritty and smoggy and atmospheric. And Pittsburgh in the 30s was all of those things. It was dominated by the steel industry. And these massive factories were just belching smoke into the atmosphere 24 hours a day. I always say that Sandra's favorite detail we learned about Pittsburgh at that time was that the streetlights were on 24 hours a day because it was so smoggy and so dark. So, I mean, it was a kind of a gift to us as writers, that kind of a setting. It just provided us so many, you know, opportunities for drama that emerged from the setting. And we both now are madly in love with Pittsburgh. And I think, I don't know, we don't live there, but we consider ourselves ambassadors.
I'm going to jump in with saying that also topographically, Pittsburgh is just so wonderful. I mean, it's got the three converging rivers, and there are numerous bridges back and forth across, and there were more bridges back when we set our tale. And then also there are these, as I said, steep ridges in there. And back then, of course, there were these wooden staircases like running down between these sort of ramshackle houses and the people that worked in the steel industry. And they just walked down these staircases towards some of the factories and so forth. And as Melanie said, the smog, and then of course the remnants of Shantytown that is actually taken down, burned down, or destroyed the year before our story is set, but still the remnants are there. It was, as Melanie said, it was our own character.
Yeah, it's a character who sets the tone, sets the mood, and that's a fun thing, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know what, I'm curious though. my series I write is usually in, it's a small contained small town, or occasionally treks out to bigger places, but they're usually contained like as an island or something. I find something about limiting access to the characters by other characters. I like to kind of make it, it's not quite Agatha Christie drawing room, but I like to have a manageable cast of characters. You just spoke about, however, that Pittsburgh, of course, is massive. It was then, it is now, and had a lot of bridges. Did you think about that consciously about, okay, wow, anybody or anything could enter this world, or was that even a consideration?
I feel like it was a possibility. That was not what we focused on.
Actually treated Pittsburgh a bit the way you're describing as a drawing room, because our characters are orphans and they don't have many resources, and they're only able to go so far as their feet can take them, unless they hop on the back of a truck or stow away on a train. So their field of play was actually quite limited in terms of our story that we were telling. And also, if you know the geography of Pittsburgh at all, the downtown is confined to this tip of, what's the word? It's not an island. It's
is it a peninsula?
Peninsula.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. I fixed that in editing. Peninsula. So it actually was a confined space. It was surrounded by water. There were bridges, but I mean, if you're a 10-year-old boy, like, are you going to be able to climb up the trussing of a bridge and cross? And what if a railroad comes across? So we treated it a bit as a drawing room, actually, now that I don't think we've ever consciously discussed that, but yeah.
But I would say to add to that is also because they were on their feet, because they were on their own, because they didn't have a house, they knew the portion of the city that they were in intimately. So in the same way that you're talking about your smaller towns, it's like they knew where they were going. They knew the ins and outs, the back alleys, the streets, the houses they could sneak into and so forth.
And we have, you know, our stories about orphans who are trying to feed themselves. And so to build on what Sandy just said, in our second book, the second book, we have a little detail about how they know when the restaurants are getting rid of their old food. They know the baking schedule of certain places. They know, so like, they know the details of where food will be. They know the details of where, you know, people will be when. They know, like, if there's a festival, it's a great place to go, you know, blend in. So they know their environment very, very well, but it is limited.
You know, and good, I know it's, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but also a good place to disappear into when you need to.
It's this is kind of the bane of all of us when we're trying to describe our books to people, because people want to say, well, what's it like, you know? And of course, when I first kind of just read about the book before I dug into it a little bit, I thought, well, this is kind of Baker Street Irregulars meets Encyclopedia Brown, perhaps. I don't know.
Oh my God, ink it.
No, yes.
Sounds great.
We'll take that.
My work here is done, ladies and gentlemen. That's great. Then good, because I grew up on both, and I look at the book, which is, by the way, a delightful cover. I love it. When I look at it, and I think this is the kind of book I would have raced to when I was in middle grade. This is the kind of book that and I was the reader kid, you know, I read but I was the kid who read, and I finished my assignments, and my teacher was just like, you can read if you'd like. And I'm like, yes, please. And I would always have something just like this. And that's what I find exciting about it too, is, it's like people are saying, it's like a lovable ragtag castle root for from page one. And I just have a feeling that's where I'd go. And you know what I think I'm going to do though, is follow the whole series, because who doesn't want to return to that part of their childhood when reading was so magical? So I just had to get that off my chest real quick and say that about this. But I was curious though, do either of you have an education? Like, were you educators at all? Or do you have children of your own? Or what led you down this path to middle grade stuff?
I think, like you, we are and were readers, especially in middle grade. And those middle grade books that we grew up on, you know, those are our foundations. Yeah. And so I can't speak for Melanie, but I think we are of the same sensibility, that we were always looking for brave kids and sweeping epic tales and fascinating backdrops, whether they're fantastical or historical, that we could kind of lose ourselves into. And I think that was our original inspiration to start this book and then also write together. I'll leave it there. Let me jump in.
There's something, use the word magic. And I think there's something about being a reader at that age that converges, like play. Like I would read books, hopefully like the ones that Sandra and I wrote, and just feel like I was caught up in a world where I was playing and I was a part of it. And I think we both, that's just, writing can be difficult. And if you're working on something that brings you back to that time where you're playing and you're happy and it's just such a joy to be in that world, I think that's what we were looking to do. At the time that we both began this project together, we had each written separately. We had each written young adult. I had written some adult books, and we both had children. And I think being able to write a middle grade was kind of allowing ourselves that freedom of, oh, we can just do this because we love it, and we can just do this because it's fun, and we can make up kids who have to climb trellises and steal, like we can just, we're going to play. And I think that's probably where it started. And then as we started figuring out how to market middle grade and work with middle grade, the idea that we were giving that experience to other young kids is pretty irresistible.
Yeah, it's got to be that moment too. When I know I'm older than you ladies, but we could order Scholastic books. You know what? Does anybody remember that?
Oh, that was the best day, right? The best day was Scholastic Book Day,
or the Scholastic Book Fair.
Oh yeah,
the book fair. Yes.
The paper. Do you remember the paper ordering form? When the teacher would hand out the paper ordering form, it was like Chris. It was like, oh, Christmas. Okay, I'm gonna check every box.
Yeah. You know, it was the one thing my parents, we were on a tight budget. There were four kids and it was a tight budget, but that was one thing my parents rarely would skimp on. They knew reading was, well, as they say, reading is fundamental. That's what they said back in the day too. And it still is. So I remember that, but this would be one of those books you just see leaping off that wonderful catalog they give us, you know, which I'm so excited about. I find myself very charmed by it too. It just takes me back. I really appreciate you doing that. Thank you. Let me ask you, you've touched on it just barely, but I was going to, so co-authoring, you've both done your own stuff on your own. And I'm actually in a co-authoring bit right now, but it's not formalized. We're trading chapters just to keep our chops. But co-authoring can be as challenging as it is rewarding. I mean, I do know that. And I'm curious about the mechanics of your writing partnership. And how do you balance the creative inputs and manage the process of writing together?
So I think when people co-author, I mean, this is my only experience co-authoring, so I'm taking a stretch here, but I think many co-authors do what you say you're doing, which is alternate chapters. And if they have a book, usually the chapters are all, you know, in different voices. So they each take a character. We didn't do that. Which I think set us up for a potential disaster. But actually in creating a single voice for this series, we discovered each other's strengths and realized how we balance each other. We each bring something to the page that is different and yet cohesive. So that was kind of a fun thing to realize.
It's actually
we had to be giving in a sense too. So authors, you know, it's like, this is my book, these are my people, but no, we had to share.
That's true. One aspect of co-authoring is that it's not just yours. It exists in its own space and it's both of yours, and it's greater than the sum of its parts. Like there are some times when we go back and read things, and Sandra will say, I love that you wrote that. And I'll say, I didn't write that. You wrote that. And we can't remember who wrote what. And that happens a lot. There's also an amazing freedom of having a partner. And when you write with them for a long time, as Sandra said, you know their strengths. And so there are times where I'm like, that isn't work. This sentence doesn't work for me. I don't know how to fix it, but I don't have to know how to fix it because Sandra's going to fix it. And and that kind of is actually quite freeing. Or we have a chapter, it's not quite working, we can't figure out how it's going to work. why it's not working, what will make it work. And then you have, you know, a 2-hour phone call and you hang up that phone and you're like, oh, we're writing the greatest book ever, because like the process of bouncing ideas off of each other and building on them is very satisfying. I mean, it's satisfying, and writing can be very lonely. It's not lonely when you have a partner at all.
Yeah. But you know, there is a stage though where you know you both have to be on the same page, pardon the pun. What if one of you, I'm not saying you did, okay, I'm just saying, but what if one of you were like, okay, we gotta, you know, but for a dumb example, I'm sure you didn't do this, but what if one of you is like, we got to kill off this character, and the other was like, absolutely not. I mean, how do you arrive at what's right and what's going to happen?
I think our heroes are still intact.
Find a co-writer who has a little bit of your shared sensibility. So, you know, like, we're not, I didn't, you know, we had like the same sort of vision. I didn't set out to write horror and she set out to write we're working for a common goal. So I guess nothing as dramatic as killing anybody, but
bad example,
but I mean, there's still time for us to kill some characters. We would definitely argue things we felt strongly about, and we've worked so long together. I think sometimes we'll call each other and say, this one's important to me. Like this, I want this to be this way. And the other person almost 100% of the time says, okay. So we defer to each other when we know this is the hill that I'm dying on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll defer to each other in that way, but nothing. Like, so
yeah, it's like the greater good. It's like the book is its own thing, and we might have different ways of approaching it.
Right.
But the outcome, I think, as Melanie said, we share a similar sensibility for the outcome. And I think we know, I mean, sometimes we're like, yeah, I know there are scenes that either of us could pick that we'd be like, I would love to just kill that scene off, you know, that didn't need to be there or something like that, but it's there it is. And I think we let go when it's okay to let go. If it's not, if something really doesn't need to be there or something really does need to be there, then we, you know, we have our arguments and we're good listeners.
I would also, just the last thing to say is that there's something great too about embracing an idea that you didn't come up with. Like, oh, like if what, yeah, right. What if we did do that? Like, I would never have thought of that. My initial instinct is I don't like that, but okay, let's just play it out. We said that to each other a lot. Like, let's play that out. Okay, let's play that out and see where that leads us. And often that led us to really exciting, fun places that we would, you know, working with a partner makes you grow a little bit, I would say.
It does. Well, you know, to me, it's like a good marriage. I love what you kept saying about the greater good. It's like, okay, look, maybe one of us wants to do this and one of us wants to do that. But then if you really have a good marriage and a good partnership, you realize, okay, but what is for the greater good? What is the better way to go here? And I think that's great. And I think that's a remarkable thing though, because, and writers don't be mad. I'm one of you, but I mean, you know, writers can be remarkably selfish about their work. And so it does take a lot of give and take when you're working with someone else. But what I do too is I try to pair up with somebody who's better than me, which is not hard to do, by the way. So that helps me tremendously. And I'm not going to force you guys to say who thinks who's better, because I'm sure you're both equally think you're both great. So
we have an answer for that, actually.
Oh, here we go. Let's go.
Well, Sandra, do you want to say what our favorite metaphor is about how our partnership works?
Well, we like to see writing as like baking a cake. And I hope that's the metaphor you were talking about.
Yeah, no, Melanie. It is.
It's like, I think we agree on the ingredients that we want to use, or what kind of cake we're making, that kind of thing, and how to mix it. But I would say that Melanie constructs the cake and I decorate it.
Yeah, that's usually how we answer this question, is that she is I will say, and I've said many times, that she writes a sentence that I could not begin to write. Like, she writes beautiful, beautiful sentences. And I have a pretty good knack for seeing the big picture. And those two things complement each other so well. So we do like to answer that question, actually, because it's actually okay to defer to your partner's strengths. And I feel like I've become such a better paragraph writer, sentence writer, granular writer, just from getting to read her sentences all the time.
So, or yeah, back at you, yeah, Melanie, right, where I'm like, oh, I see the construct. This doesn't work because this has to go here. And therefore, you know, I can't futz around over in this thing for, you know, tons of stuff gets chopped because Melanie's like, let's just cut to the chase. It's a 3-tiered cake, not a 65-tier cake.
I love it. And there's nothing crummy about that.
Ba-dum-bum.
That's so bad. It's so bad. So I was wondering, though, too, let's go back a little bit about Pittsburgh, if we could. I mean, and I've done a lot of research on my books, too, and I get it, because it's that verisimilitude you get by doing the right research and putting in those dollops of truth and factual stuff that makes it so interesting. But so sometimes the research can surprise even the most seasoned authors. So what are some of the most unexpected discoveries you made while researching these books?
Well, if you were talking about Pittsburgh itself, I would say, A, we see the map, and then the idea of 1935.
Right.
And then somehow, as we started to go back, we realized, oh, this church happened to burn down in 1935. We were able to use that. Something that I don't think is a surprise to anybody, but it was a surprise to me, and I think to Melanie, is to find out about Brown's Dump, which was this enormous slag heap that all the steel mills would dump their slag in for many decades. I think it was finally kind of closed off or filled in or whatever they did in the either late 50s or 60s or maybe even later. But for the longest time, there used to just be this enormous pit that, you know, had rail cars going around, and they would just tip the slag in and the slag would burn for days. And so people would actually go for an outing and sit and watch these sort of like lava pits, in the outside Pittsburgh, and this smoldering stuff. And to find out about that, I mean.
And also to find out, oh, that existed and we can use that.
Yeah.
Stuff like that was exciting.
A hot metal bridge, which again, transported, unrefined ore across the water. And again, we could use that bridge. So all these little details, I think we obviously took some creative license and made a few things up, but it was those small little things that were big to some people. And I'm sure people who live in Pittsburgh were like, what are you talking about? We know that, but it was all a surprise to us. And that was sort of the fun of it. And actually, Pittsburgh has changed. I mean, there are fewer bridges, different street names, different construct of streets. So we had to really make sure when we were going back that if we were using a real street, that we were naming it correctly and that we positioned it correctly. And if there was a trolley on it, for example, or not, and things like that.
And as any city or society has to, it evolves because it's no longer really a steel city anymore.
It's beautiful, filled with, had
to pivot, right? And I was thinking this, and I know this is not anywhere near where you're going, but it's just so fun. So this is middle grade, you catch them when they're so young. Wouldn't it be fun to age them up to where they were adults or grandparents in this day and age in today's Pittsburgh?
You could do that, but one thing we often talk about is we've got 11-year-olds in 1935, and they'd be teenagers during World War II.
Yeah, right.
And young 20s. So we talked about that quite a bit, actually. Like, there might be a series there.
Well, and kids need that. You were seeing it today. Sorry to editorialize, but kids largely do not understand that period of time anymore. It's just gone to them. They just don't learn it properly. You know, if they could learn it through the eyes of these kids in the Flash game. I mean, that's just gold right there. So
it's 100 years ago. It's 100, to a young kid.
It's ancient history.
90 years ago. And so like my kids are teenagers. That to them is like, it's all a wash. They kind of lump the 80s in with the 30s and they'll say, did you have color on your TV when you were young? And, so it's.
Yeah, that there wasn't, telephones were more scarce, and that, moving pictures, if you could afford it, you might be able to go for a day and watch all kinds of reels, but most kids could not. And then radio was a big thing. So radio does figure into our story a lot.
But it has been fun to kind of reintroduce that world to new readers, because I think they're, as you said, they're just not familiar with, they don't have a grasp of like the historical record.
Right. Or a streeter brigade, which we use, which is like a word of mouth that can fly through the streets, but it's not like you have a cell phone or something, but it's like how you can be, how you can figure out how to make things work when you're a kid. Like you can get yourself out of scrapes without, you know, social media or technology.
Right. And that's kind of a, you know, I had to walk uphill to school both ways in the snow.
That's
kind of true. But, you know, just I can't let you get away without asking you this, though. I mean, these kids are going after, you know, pro-Nazi stuff here. And I just have to ask, look where we are today, where this crap, excuse me, is on the rise again. And I'm just curious how do you see a new layer of significance on top of not only the historical stuff we just mentioned, but on really like reflecting and letting these kids understand about just how awful these sentiments are?
I think this started as we were writing this fun little historical book set. I mean, we worked on this for many years, and at one point we were like, oh, we'll just make, you know, your typical bad guy and we'll make them American Nazis. And then there was a moment in our recent history where we suddenly realized that, oh, this is not just a historical anymore. This is actually relevant to what's happening now. And I think we both took that responsibility pretty seriously. And then we did a lot of research into that time and the political movements that were happening at that time. And I think the kind of whitewashed history you're taught is that we were on the right side all the time. And we were, you know, anti-Nazi the entire time in the 30s and the 40s. And there was a prominent portion of the public that was not at that time. And so I think it was exciting to be able to bring that up and say, you know, there's choices that have to be made. You could easily choose one side or the other, and it's not a given that you're going to come out on the right side of history. And so I think we took that very seriously, that all of a sudden our bad guys seemed very relevant and a teaching tool, unfortunately.
Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so, of course, there's somebody else that most kids today don't recall who he was, but to hear that Charles Lindbergh was really immersed in, he was a fascist, let's just say it.
And Henry Ford.
The biggest, you know, anti-Semite, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of these politicians, and they were anti-Semitic openly and proudly.
Yeah. Who was the minister or priest that was on the radio, Father Coughlin?
Father Coughlin.
Who had, you know, the equivalent of, I mean, what, 5 to 10 million people or whatever tuned into him every week, and he spouted hateful things. So there's a lot of mirroring here seeing.
It's like, hey, kids at home, Tucker Carlson, although he's off TV now. That was like Father Coughlin. I mean, you know, but it's done obviously not with a, you know, after school special, kids, here's the lesson. It's part of the intriguing story you're telling. And that's the thing too, right? Because kids don't want to feel preached to, but they just want to make it as an organic part of the story that, oh, these are not good people.
You know? We hope we did that. You know, we have a very personal element to the story, which is one of the characters is it's a personal mission that he's on. And then our second lead character is sort of the one who has the larger context. And so hopefully we're able to teach without teaching doing it in a way that's entertaining. And the character who tends to be the most vocal about those kinds of large issues is very colorful and funny. So hopefully the medicine goes down with some sugar.
There you go.
Yes.
So the Adventures of the Flash Gang is episode one, is the exploding experiment. And then that's followed up by episode two, The Treasonous Tycoon, which is just hit the stores in January of this
next
year,
week.
Right?
Yeah, no,
it's coming out this week.
No.
Okay.
Yes. March 5th. Spring.
Okay. I read it wrong. Sorry. And and then you've got another one down the road from this one, right?
Yeah, we just handed in the proofread edits. So that's coming out next March. So yeah, that will be the end of the series. It's a trilogy.
I used to say that. Now I'm on book nine. I'm on book nine of my series. Come on. No, but you know, you're gonna have kids rioting when they find out there's only three of these. I'm just telling you this right now.
Oh.
Hey, by the way, everybody, if you want to know more about these intriguing authors, it's downingwaugh.com, and that's Downing, and then WAUGH.com. Kind of like Evelyn, everybody. Mm-hmm. Evelyn Waugh, you know that name. There's Instagram, there's Facebook, there's all that stuff. But guess what? I've saved you the trouble of stopping everything and scribbling it down right now, because it's going to be in your show notes. So just go look in your show notes, and be sure to go to mgopod.com, where we have pictures of the book and links and all kinds of stuff. It's going to be great. So make sure you check that out. I'm going to throw it back to Downing and Waugh, though, and just say, I'm giving you the last word here. After I say this, this is a great book to give your middle grade kids. I think they're going to fall in love with it. Like I said earlier, it's really got Baker Street Irregulars and Encyclopedia Brown written all over it. And to me, that's a high compliment. I just think it's going to be great. So I've just enjoyed the heck out of meeting you both. And I'm really excited for you and your series. But I'll throw it back to you if you have any final words here.
Thank you, Alex. Melanie?
The other wonderful part of having a partnership is that you always expect the other one will have the last word. But this has been actually a really fun conversation, and this has been so nice of you to have us. We are very honored to be able to talk to you about our trilogy, which we love so much.
And the honor is all mine. And ladies, the door is always open. You've got a couple more books coming down the pike here, so you know where to find us. And again, listeners, make sure you check out mgopod.com. And again, Downing and Waugh, thank you so very much for joining us right here on Mysterious Goings On.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. Be sure to follow Mysterious Goings On wherever you get your podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget, you can get the links to books and other things mentioned on the show at mgopod.com. Until next time, keep reading.